Chapter 11. On April 15th, 1959, the very same day on which Chun Chin got his job with Raymond on transfer from the Soviet Army, another military transfer occurred. Major Marco was placed on indefinite sick leave and detached from duty. Marco had undergone two series of psychiatric treatments at Army hospitals. As the recurring nightmare had grown more vivid, the pathological fatigue had gotten more severe. No therapy had been successful. Marco had weighed 208 pounds when he had come into New York from Korea. At the time he went on indefinite sick leave, he weighed in at 163, and he looked a little nuts. Every nerve end in his body had grown a small ticklish mustache, and they sidled along under his skin like eager touts, screaming on tiptoe. He had the illusion that he could see and hear everything at once, and had lost all of his ability to edit either sight or sound. Sound particularly detonated his reflexes. He tried desperately not to listen when people talked, because an open A sound, repeated several times within a sentence, could make him weep uncontrollably. He didn't know why. So he concentrated on remembering the cause when he could, so that he would not listen so attentively. But it didn't work. It was an A sound that must have been somewhat like a sound he had heard many, many years before, in utter peace and safety, which, through its loss, or through his indifference to it over the years, could now cause him to weep bitterly. If he heard the sound occur once, he quickly hummed La Sen to push the A sound off to the side. His hand tremors were pronounced when his arm was extended unsupported. Sometimes his teeth would chatter as though he had entered a chill. Once in a while, after four or five unrelieved nights of nightmare, he developed a bad facial tic, and it wasn't pretty. Marco was being rubbed into sand by the grinding stone of two fealties. He was being slowly rubbed away by two faiths he lived by, far beyond his control. The first was his degree of holy reverence for the Medal of Honor, one of the most positive prejudices of his life, because his life principally was the army. And the second was the abnormal degree of his friendship for Raymond Shaw, which had been placed upon his mind, as coffee will leave a stain upon a fresh snowy tablecloth, by the deepest psychological conditioning. When Marco completed, for the want of any other word, the second course of treatment, and was ordered to rest, they knew he was through, and he knew they knew it. He headed for New York to talk to Raymond. He had never been able to tell the doctors the part of the dream where Raymond killed Mavoli and Lembeck on a continuous performance basis, and he had not allowed himself to mention every phase of the four variations on the drill that had been used to win Raymond the Medal of Honor. He had written to Al Melvin, and between them he and Melvin had spent over $300 talking to each other on the long-distance telephone, and it had brought considerable relief to each to know that the other was suffering as deeply from the same malady. But it did not stop the nightmares. Marco knew that he must talk to Raymond. He must. Absolutely must. He knew that if he did not talk to Raymond about most of the details in his dreams, he would die from them. Ironically, as Marco was riding one train to New York, Raymond was riding another to Washington. Marco sat like a stone in the train chair, riding sideways in the club car. The car was about half filled. Almost all of the seats were occupied at one end, Marco's end, by businessmen, or what seemed to be businessmen, but were actually an abortionist, an orchestra leader, a low church clergyman, an astrologer, a Boy Scout executive, a horticulturalist, and a cinematographer. Because no matter how much they would like the world to think so, the planet is not populated entirely by businessmen, no matter how banal the quality of conversation everywhere has become. Some women were present. Their dresses gave the car the only embarrassing touch of color, excepting the garish decorations on the upper left side of Marco's blouse. Marco had a rye old-fashioned placed on the round metal stand in front of him, but he hadn't tasted it. He kept wishing he had ordered beer, not to taste, and he was careful not to look at anybody because he had stopped doing that several weeks before. He sweated continuously. His face had very little color. His palms drenched his trousers at the tops of his knees. He was battling to make a decision as to whether he wanted to smoke a cigar or not. His eyes burned. He felt an agony of weariness. His stomach hurt. He concentrated for an instant on not clenching his teeth, but he could not retain the thought. His jaws were tired, and some doctor had told him that he would grind the dentine off his molars if he didn't concentrate on not clenching his jaws. He turned his body slightly, but not his head, toward the person sitting beside him, a woman. "Do you mind cigar smoke?" he mumbled. "Not at all," she murmured. He turned away from her, but made no move to find a cigar. "Go ahead," she said. "As a matter of fact, I wish you'd smoke two cigars at the same time."
"You must really like cigar smoke."
"Not especially, but I think two cigars going at the same time would look awfully amusing." He turned his body again toward the woman sitting beside him. He lifted his eyes slowly, hesitantly, beyond the long scarlet-tipped fingers at repose in her lap, past a shining silver belt buckle shaped as Quetzalcoatl, an urbane feathered serpent, past up-tilted, high-setting, pronounced breasts that stared back at him eyelessly through dark blue wool, past the high neckline and the discreet seed pearls around a long throat of white Carrara marble, to a mouth whose shape he had yearned to see in living flesh since he had seen its counterpart within a photograph he had found in a German magazine 23 years before, rolled up in his father's effects in the trunk of a command car. In abstract, it was a sexual object. It was a witty mouth. It looked insatiable. It told him about lust, which had been lost far back in mythology, lust which could endow its tasters with eternal serenity, and it was the mouth of many varieties of varying kinds of woman. He regretted having to leave off his concentration on the sight of it. With difficulty, he moved his eyes upward to the questing horn of a most passionate nose, a large, formed, aquiline, and Semitic nose, the nose of a seeker and a finder of glories. And it made him remember that every Muslim who attains heaven is allotted 72 women who must look exactly like this between the eyes and the mouth. And he thought across the vast, vast distance of the Huanacauri rock of Incan puberty to the words of the black, black, black song that keened, "If she on earth no more I see, my life will quickly fade away." Then at last, his eyes came to the level of the eyes of a Tuareg woman, and he rushed past a random questioning as to whether the Berlitz schools taught Temajig, and he thought of the god of love who was called bodiless by the Hindus because he was consumed by the fire of Shiva's eyes. Then he closed his own eyes and tried to help himself, to stop himself, to sweet God in heaven. He could not. He began to weep. He stumbled to his feet. The passengers across the aisle stared at him hostily. He knocked his drink over and the metal stand over. He turned blindly and noisily to the left, unable to stop weeping, and made it from behind the wet opaqueness to the train door and the vestibule. He stood alone in the vestibule and put his head against the window and waited for time to pass, feeling confident that it would pass, when his motor would run down and the sobbing would slowly subside. Trying to analyze what had happened, as though to fill his mind, he was forced into the conclusion that the woman must have looked the way that open A sounded to him, an open, effortless, problemless, safe, and blessed look. What color had her hair been, he wondered as he wept. He concentrated upon the words by which angels had been known. Yaztas, Fravashi, and Amasha Spentas, Seraphim and Cherubim, Hayot, Ophanim, Aralim, and Harut and Marut, who had said, "We are only a temptation. Be not then an unbeliever." He decided that the woman could only be one of the Fravashi, that army of angels that has existed in heaven before the birth of man, that protects him during his life and is united to his soul at death. He sobbed while he conjectured about the color of her hair. At last, he was permitted to stop weeping. He leaned against the train wall in exhaustion, riding backward. He took a handkerchief slowly from his trousers pocket, and with an effort of strength which he could not replenish with sleep, slowly dried his face, then blew his nose. He thought, only fleetingly, that he could not go back into that club car again, but that there would be plenty of other seats in the other direction, toward the rear of the train. When he got to New York, he decided, he would pull on a pair of gray slacks and a red woolen shirt, and he'd sit all day on the rim of the map of the United States behind Raymond's big window, looking out at the Hudson River and that state, whatever its name was, on the other shore, and think about the states beyond that state, and drink beer. When he turned to find another seat in another car, she was standing there. Her hair was the color of birch bark, prematurely white, and he stared at her as though her thyroid were showing its excessive activity and her hypereroticism.
She stood smoking a new cigarette, leaning back, riding forward, and looking out of the window.